the history of the air we breathe. Air is invisible, so it's easy not to think about it, to take it for granted. But air consists of molecules that make up gases, lots of gases. And those molecules and gases have been around for a long time. Where did they all come from, and who has inhaled and exhaled the very air we breathe before us? These are just a few of the questions author Sam Keen considers in his new book, Caesar's Last Breath, and other true tales of history, science, and the sextillions of molecules in the air around us. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Sam Keen joins us today to share his journey into thin air, from the formation of our atmosphere to some of the scientists who have discovered important gases, to the impact of atomic tests. What do you want to know about every breath you take? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Air is something you might only think about when you're struggling to catch your breath or reading about air pollution. But did you know there is an entire history to the air we breathe? Today, my guest is a best-selling science writer who makes the world of science accessible, understandable, and fun. Sam Keen's latest book is Caesar's Breath. It's all about the molecules in the air around us. Sam Keen joins me in the studio. And as always, we want to hear from you. What are your questions about the air you breathe? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Sam Keen, welcome to Maine. Your book, kind of a history of air, that's an ambitious topic.
Yeah, it's a big topic, but it's an important one. There's a lot of debate and discussion about the air, air pollution, global warming, things like that. But the premise of Caesar's Last Breath was to sort of tell people the history of the air. I think we all are obviously aware of the air, but probably don't know where it comes from, how it's changed over the history of the Earth, how it's changing exactly today. And so that was the premise of the book, just to kind of inform us what the air actually is and to make it more visible than it is.
How did you come up with the idea?
So when I'm trying to come up with a book, what I want to do is have a big topic. I've written books about, funny stories on the periodic table. I've written ones about the human genome, about the wonders of the human brain. So there's always kind of a central scientific topic. But what I really like to do is have that central topic and then jump into stories about a lot of other areas of life. So there are stories in my books about poisons and war and our history as a species, about art and painting and music. And air was a topic I knew where I really could do that, jump into a lot of different topics, not just scientific, but topics about just human beings and really tell stories about people. That's really what the book is a collection of different stories about the air and how it's shaped our history and civilization in hidden ways.
The title, Caesar's Last Breath, and I'm not giving away anything because it's in the first chapter.
It's right away.
You're considering that, Caesar's famous last breath is something all of us are inhaling a part of every day. And thinking about the air really is something that has been recycled pretty much through history.
Yeah, so the title, Caesar's Last Breath, comes from a sort of challenge problem that I got when I was in high school and college, and I think other people probably did as well, where they ask you, what are the odds that right now you are breathing at least one molecule that Julius Caesar also breathed during his last breath when he was assassinated? And I think a lot of us initially would think, no way. I mean, there's no way that something as ephemeral as a breath could still possibly be around. But as I explained in the introduction, when you look at the details of air, look at how many molecules you're actually breathing, the gigantic number of them, when you look at how hardy air molecules are, the fact that they last a long time, the odds are very, very good that every single time you take a breath, you're breathing in some of the same air that Julius Caesar breathed when he was assassinated. And really, there's no reason to limit yourself to Julius Caesar. That's kind of the name that comes up all the time. But any famous person in history, Amelia Earhart, Confucius, a relative of yours, you're breathing the same air they breathed as well. So it really is one thing, a material thing that connects us with all of history.
As you bring up in the book, and as I sit here in the studio and look around, Air is invisible. So it's hard to sometimes, as humans, get our heads around this. We like to be able to see things. So tell me, if you could see them, how many molecules are we breathing every time we breathe an average size breath?
So it's roughly 25 sextillion molecules, which is too big of a number to really comprehend. It's something like a 25 with 21 zeros after it. And in the book, I make a bit of an analogy that if you took Bill Gates' fortune and you multiplied those two numbers, it's something like 80 billion at the time I wrote the book. If you took every dollar in Bill Gates' bank account, and so every individual dollar, and then made each of those $80 billion have its own $80 billion, you'd still be short of the number of molecules we breathe every time we breathe air. It's a gigantic, gigantic number of molecules.
So what is our air made up of? What is it mainly? What else is in there? I know you wrote a whole book about this,
yep.
But give us the primer.
So 80% of the air that we're breathing is nitrogen molecules, N2 they're called. 20% or so is oxygen molecules. And, you know, you might have noticed that already, and actually I should
You're already at 100.
Yeah, well, it's actually 78% is nitrogen.
Okay.
21% is oxygen. So that's about 99%. And a lot of people say then, well, you know, that's 99%. Like, how much does the rest of the air really matter? And the answer is it kind of matters a lot. I often make an analogy with a glass of wine or something, where over 99% of the molecules in a glass of wine are either water molecules or alcohol molecules. But if you think a glass of wine is just some water mixed with alcohol, I mean, you're crazy. There's the flavors in it. There's the overtones, the finish. Those are the things that make wine wine. And it's a lot the same way with our air. That 1% is very, very important. All global warming, all of it comes from that 1%. Everything you can smell, whether it's baking bread, perfume, a barbecue, something like that, all of that comes from that extra 1%. So that 1% is really what makes the air the air.
So you kind of start at the beginning, and you start about the formation of the atmosphere in your book. And I learned so much, but I want you to tell us about, this is something, and maybe it's because I didn't major in science in college, I had never heard of the Great Oxygen Catastrophe. Can you tell our audience, what is the Great Oxygen Catastrophe?
Yeah, it's kind of a surprising thing in that we associate oxygen with life. I mean, if we can't get oxygen, we know we're going to struggle to breathe. We know we're going to die. But actually, for the vast majority of life forms that have ever lived on Earth, oxygen was a poison. And there's still a lot of microbes today that if you expose them to oxygen, it will poison them. It will kill them. So there was a time, a long time ago, a few billion years ago, when these creatures would produce oxygen as a byproduct, and they would actually release it. They would exhale it the way that we exhale carbon dioxide, because we don't want it in our bodies. We get rid of it. They would exhale oxygen. And unfortunately for them, they were so successful, they started producing so much oxygen that it became a pollutant, and it started to kill them off. And it very nearly came close to wiping out life on Earth. It was kind of a close thing that life pulled through. It would be like imagining us walking around with a bunch of chlorine gas in the air. It was searing our lungs. It's what it was like for a lot of these microbes. And eventually, of course, some of our microbial ancestors pulled through. They learned how to not only tolerate but harness oxygen to do a lot of powerful, interesting things. And we kind of owe them a debt of gratitude in the fact that we are able to exist today, because complicated, complex life, things that can run and jump and breathe, wouldn't be possible without the oxygen. But for a long time, oxygen was a deadly poison. And that Great Oxygen Catastrophe refers to that time when life almost got wiped out on Earth because of this gas that we now associate with life.
And so many things contributed to what our atmosphere is today, but volcanoes, obviously, the moving of tectonic plates. It's almost too big to conceive of.
Yeah, in a way, you can talk about the history of air as the history of Earth. So the history of the gases on our planet really are a history of Earth looked at through slightly different lens. And things like volcanoes, as you said, were big contributors to the early atmospheres we had.
So I want to fast forward a little bit. your book goes through and tells us a story of many of these scientists who have discovered gases or discovered properties of gases. And the one thing that strikes me, Sam, as I step back and think about what I've read, is this is really a tale of a lot of people with extraordinary tenacity, extraordinary commitment to finding out this one little thing, something that takes them years or maybe decades, and often they lose their life to it.
Yeah, there were some unfortunate cases in the book where people did lose their lives. I mean, you could generally say that about scientists, that they are dedicating themselves to finding things out that take a lot of work. It's really amazing some of the things they can discover. But unfortunately, there were a few discoveries in the book where I talk about, especially with the discovery of oxygen, the first few scientists who discovered that, one of them accidentally poisoned himself. Another one, Joseph Priestley, basically got run out of England, had to move to the United States. Another one, Antoine Lavoisier, ended up getting beheaded during the French Revolution, in part because of the scientific work that he was doing and that he was involved in. So oxygen especially has kind of a curse on it. But there were other examples, too, of people, you know, getting in trouble or losing their lives due to either bungling or other things that happened with their study of the atmosphere.
Speaking of oxygen, tell me what phlogiston is. Am I pronouncing that right?
A phlogiston, I think.
A phlogiston.
So it's basically the old version of what we thought was in the air. So before we really understood what the air was made of, that was mostly oxygen and nitrogen, there were various theories about what in the air kind of gave us life, gave us energy, things like that. And one of these was called phlogiston. It was very closely related to fire, especially. So they thought when you burned something that it released phlogiston, and that to get the phlogiston back, you had to do all these things to it. So it was kind of this theory about how fire and energy worked back then. And it's a very funny word. It has a PH at the beginning, and it just looks like a very quaint, old-fashioned word. So it's kind of a fun antiquarian thing that I talk about in the book.
But it's not even that long ago, really, historically speaking. We haven't understood the composition of air that long.
Yeah, before the United States was the United States. I mean, that was 1770s. We declared our independence. But after that, people were still dealing with this idea of phlogiston. They didn't know what the atmosphere was made of at the time. So, yeah, within the lifetime of our country, we have discovered all these amazing things about the air.
Are there things we still don't know about the air? Is it possible that there are other molecules that have yet to be discovered?
Yeah, it's possible that there are molecules out there waiting to be discovered. More what we don't know quite about the air, we haven't quite wrapped our heads around it, is more like the mass movements of the air. So we have a general idea with, you know, how the weather works and things like that, but there are a lot of details that we don't know. And especially as we move forward, as we're talking about things like climate change, formation of clouds, there's still a lot of details that we just don't know. And one exciting thing that we're moving into that we don't know is looking at the atmospheres of other planets. Because there are telescopes going up now where they're going to be looking at the atmospheres of planets around other stars. And we're going to be start looking for life around those planets as well. And the way we're possibly going to discover life on other planets is by looking at their atmospheres, figuring out the gases, the mix of gases in their atmosphere, and making a judgment call about whether that seems like an atmosphere that would have life or not. If aliens were looking at our atmosphere, it'd be very easy for them to tell that we have not only life here, but intelligent life here, because you can find certain gases that just don't appear in nature, and there's no way they could have been produced in nature unless there was a creature, an intelligent creature like human beings, producing them. So an alien looking at us could easily tell there was intelligent life here, and we're going to be looking for those same signals around other planets in the fairly near future.
So how can a scientist looking through a telescope tell the makeup of an atmosphere on another planet, especially another planet around another star?
That's so distant, yeah. So basically what happens is they have to kind of get lucky with the arrangement of the planets, and the planet is basically going to move in front of its star. And as the planet moves in front of its star, basically gets between the star and us, the planet itself is usually opaque, so it's going to block a little bit of that light. But there's a tiny corona of the atmosphere around that planet, And as the sunlight from that other star filters through that very small corona, it's going to absorb certain wavelengths of light. And it's a very, very tiny, subtle effect. But if you watch for long enough and have a powerful enough telescope, you actually can see a little tiny bit of dimming and learn what must be in the atmosphere of those planets. So it's really incredible technical work, but they are getting pretty close to being able to do it.
And it's really kind of, again, new, a relatively new way of looking for extraterrestrial life. We scientists have been looking for a while, but looking for different things, not looking at atmospheres.
Right.
Correct?
Basically, we're looking for, you know, a signal that says hello coming down from the sky. But this is a much more probably robust and likely way to find some sort of life.
As you did your research, and I know you've written several books about science, so you must always have things that just surprise and delight you. Is there one in this whole book that was the most surprising and most delightful for you to discover?
There's a chapter about ballooning in there that I really enjoyed writing about, researching things like that, and just how world-changing ballooning was. A lot of people were very excited about it. I didn't know that it was used, there was kind of a big sport around it, kind of the daredevils of their day. You know, nowadays they're mountain climbing or whatever. Back then they were balloonists. They were celebrities. People loved following their favorite balloonist. A lot of people were scared of balloons as well. There are stories in there about balloons descending from the sky as they lost their buoyancy. They would land in a farmer's field and they would run out with pitchforks and attack it because this big thing had fallen down from the sky. They didn't know what it was. So that chapter kind of jumps to mind as something that was really fun to write about. And there's a lot of good science in there, not only the science of balloons and how they work, but the science they were able to do by launching themselves up high into the atmosphere and studying what was different about the atmosphere up there.
And we're still using balloons to study the atmosphere.
We still, high-altitude balloons are still a very important part of atmospheric research, yeah.
We're talking with science writer Sam Keen. His most recent book is Caesar's Last Breath and Other True Tale of History, Science, and the Sextillions of Molecules in the Air Around Us. We still haven't talked about human impact on the air we breathe, and we'll do that after our break. Also, if you have questions for Sam, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can email talk@mainpublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Hospice of Southern Maine. Calling Hospice doesn't mean you're giving up. It means you're taking charge. Learn more at hospiceofsouthernmaine.org. And the Lunder Foundation, founding partner of Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Classical.
Since President Trump was elected, the city of Portland, Oregon has seen violent protests between the far left and far right.
How am I supposed to explain this to my 12-year-old daughter, that we allow adults to fight on the streets of our city?
I'm Audie Cornish. What happens when civil protest boils over into civil unrest? This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening. All this week here on Maine Public Radio, on both Morning Edition and All Things Considered, how the proposed Central Maine Power Transmission Line will impact Western Maine, the state, the economy, and the environment. This evening on All Things Considered, we'll explore some of the potential economic consequences of the project. And tomorrow on Morning Edition, the environmental consequences of the project, and how some are looking to strike a balance between a potential climate change benefit and possible threats to the ecosystems of Western Maine. Power Struggle in the Maine Woods on Maine Public Radio, on both Morning Edition and All Things Considered, with more on the web at mainepublic.org/power.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the history and science behind the air we breathe. Joining me, Sam Keen. His most recent book is Caesar's Last Breath. His next book, coming out this summer, The Bastard Brigade. Sam is a best-selling author, and his writing has appeared in numerous national magazines. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. In your book, Sam, the first sort of two-thirds is about discovering
and learning about the air around us and gases. But then you start talking about or writing about how we as humans have changed the composition of the air we breathe. And, and you know, obviously a big part of that is the amount of carbon in the atmosphere and methane because of the industrial revolution. Can you put into perspective how much we as humans have changed the air we breathe?
Yeah, so a lot of it did come, it's sort of starting with the Industrial Revolution, where we started putting things like carbon dioxide, maybe some methane, chlorofluorocarbons and other things into the atmosphere that do warm up our atmosphere. And one thing I talk about in the book is that, you know, global warming isn't all bad, in that if you looked at just where our planet is, based on its orbit around the sun, if we had no global warming at all, the average temperature on Earth would be something like right around 30 degrees Fahrenheit, which means we would have basically no liquid water. I mean, it'd be a very different place for the – it'd be about 0 degrees Fahrenheit. So it'd be a very cold place. Whereas because of that, we have global warming. We have something like average temperature of 60 degrees. So some global warming is good. The balance, though, has been completely shifted and thrown out of whack, or it's getting that way, because of recent industrial activity. And I think they can look at ice cores in the Arctic and Antarctic to figure out roughly what the level of carbon dioxide was before the Industrial Revolution. And it's something like 250 parts per million. Nowadays, it's getting, I think it's past 400, getting close to 450. So it's getting to the point where it's nearly doubled, and we're starting to see the temperature rise. And, you know, any gas that has three different molecules attached to it, so CO2 has three molecules, H2O, water is actually a very big and potent part of global warming, other molecules as well, cause this global warming effect where they trap heat and cause the atmosphere, the temperature to rise.
How much of a percentage of the air around us is CO2?
That's one thing that's kind of hard to wrap your head around, because it seems like a very minuscule amount. I mean, 400 parts per million is a very, very small amount. It would be something like 0.004 or so percent, maybe it's 0.04% of the molecules that are in the atmosphere. So it seems like it shouldn't really make a difference, but it does make a big, big difference.
The part of your book that I think alarmed me the most, Sam, was when you're talking about not only the development of the atomic bomb, but also all the testing that went on in the 50s especially. I don't know if most people realize how many atomic tests there were and how much radiation it put into our atmosphere.
Yeah, it was a little scary how much of that got into the air, where it drifted without their really understanding the weather patterns and where it was going to go, how much fell down on people. And the fact that it did almost certainly, we can say statistically, probably did cause a rash of cancer, in especially things like thyroid cancer, very susceptible to that sort of work or that sort of exposure to radioactivity. And in the United States, there were definitely cases of that. And there were other cases in the Marshall Islands especially, where we exploded some of our biggest atomic bombs, where they have absolutely been able to trace higher levels of cancer and other developmental disorders to the fact that people were exposed almost directly to the effects of fallout and other things like that.
And radiation has a long half-life, so that radiation is still in our atmosphere, isn't it?
It is. Some of it has decreased, and so it's not as bad as it was at the peak in the 1960s, but some of that still is around in our atmosphere today and still is getting into our bodies. It can still damage our DNA, things like that. So we're still dealing with those effects to this day.
Do we have a sense of, you said there would be more cases of cancer, what kind of increase the radiation from all the atomic testing did to not only people in the United States, but around the world?
I forget the exact number, but they estimated, I believe it was several thousand cases at least, more than there would have been if not for this increase in especially carbon-14 and other things, strontium, iodine, radioactive iodine, things like that.
One thing you write about is some of the experiments that have been done is terms of people trying to control the weather, and as we well know, that they haven't been successful.
Right.
But I want to connect it with something else you write about. At the very end, you talk about climate change, and you come to the conclusion that humans are not going to change, that we're not going to be able to control this beast, if you will.
Mm. Yeah, basing that, I mean, it sounds a bit cynical, but I'm basing that just on the fact that a lot of us know about this, we're concerned about it, and yet we kind of keep doing the same things that we keep doing. I don't think that should be an excuse for us to not change at all. And I think that there are actually some good news out there about the possibilities of sort of changing these things. For instance, the cost of solar power has been plummeting and is still plummeting. And so we have an opportunity to do these kind of things. I am more cynical about the idea I think we can replace some of our energy sources. I'm less optimistic about the idea that we're really going to change our lifestyles a lot. And especially when you're looking at developing countries, they want to get up to the basic level standard of living that we have in these countries. And it would be unfair of us to say, no, they can't do something like that. But that is going to increase the amount of carbon dioxide and other things in the atmosphere. So in the book, I talk about some of the possible solutions that we could have to sort of technological solutions to try to deal with those kind of things. And I should mention that I did just jot it down and figure it out. It's about 0.04% of our atmosphere that is carbon dioxide right now.
So you just jotted it down and figured it out as I was talking to you.
Yeah.
One of your thoughts about climate change, and this is why I tied it to weather, is thinking about the kind of climate engineering that people are talking about. Mm. If we can't control a rainstorm or a hurricane, how can we potentially engineer the climate?
It is a bit scary. I mean, in some ways, we can't like control our washing machines and things. I mean, much less the weather. So imagining engineering a whole climate would be a pretty scary thing. And frankly, there scientists who do this kind of work admit they don't know a lot of what's going on. Their rationale is that, well, you know, we know things are probably going to get pretty bad if we just let things go on as they are. So possibly we should do things like look at spraying sulfur dioxide in the atmosphere, which could reflect sunlight back into space. We could talk about other things, sucking carbon out of the air. So it is a bit scary, and we don't know exactly what's going to happen, but there are people who make the argument that between the two alternatives, trying to engineer the atmosphere a little bit is the safer and the one that we should at least have it in our sort of repertoire of things we can do to mitigate climate change.
Because at the rate we're going, humans will no longer inhabit the planet.
That's one thing I talk about is, life has been around on Earth for a long time. Life will continue past the point of climate change. Climate change is not going to end life on Earth. It might unfortunately disrupt human civilization or potentially even human life on Earth. So that's something I think worth preserving, and that's why I think these kind of solutions are worth looking at, and caring about the atmosphere is something worth doing. I want to preserve human civilization and human life.
I mean, you get pretty sci-fi at the end of your book.
A little bit. I talk about, you know, visiting another planet and things like that based on what we were talking about earlier about being able to detect life on other planets, things like that. But I think it's sort of fun sometimes. It's something I try to do with my books, is not only tell these fun stories, but try to expand people's minds a little bit. So going a little sci-fi can be fun. It can be a good way to do that.
Let me just ask you about what I believe is maybe one of the overarching themes of this book, is that you look at the air we breathe and it's something we take for granted. And I think what you're saying is stop. This is very precious and fragile, and don't take it for granted.
Yeah, there is a sense, we all learned in elementary school that there's solids out there, there's liquids out there, there's gases out there. But we pay vastly more attention to the solids and liquids, things like food, material possessions are solid, you know, liquids, things like water. But, you know, you could get by without food for a week or so. You could buy without water for a few days even, and you would pull through that. Without the air around you, you would last, you know, a few minutes at most before you'd be dead. It's the most precious thing around you all the time, and yet it's something we barely pay attention to. So the book's trying to make us pay attention, try to make us appreciate the air around us.
Message from Michael. I've read Sam's book. It was great. It is wonky science, but fun to read. You can pick the book up, and most people could follow the narrative. It is trying not to be intimidating about science, because science is pretty intimidating to many people.
It can be. Sometimes it gets a little technical, things like that. So the book avoids all technical language, things like that. It's pitched at kind of a general reader, someone who wants to know about the air or the genome or the brain or whatever it is in my books. And again, really emphasizes the stories, the human beings involved. There are heroes and villains, conflict and drama, good guys, bad guys, all those good things that make a juicy story are the things I try to bring into the books.
So one of your previous books was about the periodic table, Sam. Probably just as I said that there are people in our audience who shuddered.
Bad memories,
but you
bad flashbacks.
You love the periodic table.
I do. I think it's fascinating. The premise of the book, it's called The Disappearing Spoon, was to find kind of a funny or spooky or unusual story about every single element on the periodic table. And I did manage to cram every one of them in there. And it was a really fun book because that one especially really gave me a chance to talk about the periodic table in war, the periodic table in poison, the periodic table in art and music. There's a chapter about bubbles in there. I mean, there's just so many areas of life that intersect with the periodic table if you just scratch a little bit deeper and really dig into the stories.
All right. And tell us about your other books. You have The Tale of the Dueling Neurosurgeons. What are you looking at there?
So that book is about neuroscience, obviously. And the premise of it is the fact that neuroscience, until about 25 or so years ago, the only way you could study how the brain works, unfortunately, was to wait for people to get injured in some part of their brain and then study how their behavior changed after this. People would get injured in one part of the brain, they would lose all memory. People would get injured in another part of the brain, they would lose the ability to speak or to see. So the book looks at a lot of very unusual case studies and figures out how the brain works based on how people's behaviors changed. So some people started lying incessantly after a brain injury. Other people couldn't recognize their children anymore. Other people lost all ability to recognize plants or animals or different things like that. So based on these very specific changes in how the brain works in these case studies, you can basically learn how your own brain works. So it's kind of a book to make you and help you understand how your own brain works.
Tell me about The Violinist's Thumb.
The Violinist's Thumb is about genetics and kind of the intersection of genetics and human life. The story itself, the title story, is about a very famous geneticist or a very famous violinist, I should say, named Niccolo Paganini, who was active in Europe in the very early 1800s and had these kind of amazingly, even freakishly flexible hands. And that's one of the reasons he was such an amazing violinist. The story that always sticks in my mind is that he could put his hand down. I encourage everyone to try this, see if they can get even close. He could put his hand down flat on a table, palm down on a table, and he could lift his pinky and his thumb up and then touch them behind his hand while laying it flat on the table. So he could do things with his hands that were sort of freakish that you should not be able to do with his hands. And from a modern perspective, it's almost certain he had a genetic disorder of some sort that gave him very kind of freakishly flexible joints. But because of these very flexible hands, they gave him a big advantage while playing the violin and helped make him an amazing violinist. So that intersection of genetics and medicine and music is something you might not think would be obvious, but if you look a little bit at Paganini's life, that really jumps out. So that's why I called the book The Violinist's Thumb.
Well, we're speaking with science writer Sam Keen. When we come back, we'll ask him about his new book going to come out this summer, The Bastard Brigade. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine calling possible. As do Toyota, introducing the new 2019 Toyota Prius, available with electric all-wheel drive. ToyotaPriusAWD.com. And the Grasshopper Shop of Rockland, with items for your kitchen, garden, bath, and boudoir. Open daily year-round at 400 Main Street. On the next Speaking in Maine, Turkey, wayward ally.
Future U.S.-Turkish relations will be conducted on a strictly transactional basis.
Alan Makovsky is a senior fellow for national security and international policy at the Center for American Progress. He spoke at the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations in Northport about U.S. relations with Turkey. That's coming up on Speaking in Maine, Tuesday afternoon at 2 on Maine Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, comic, writer, and actor John Mulaney. He used to write for Saturday Night Live and returned twice in the past year to host the show. He also does the voice of Andrew in the animated series Big Mouth about adolescence and puberty. His comedy special, Kid Gorgeous, at Radio City, is streaming on Netflix. Join us.
Fresh Air is tonight at 7 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, best-selling science writer Sam Keen joins us to talk about the history of the air we breathe and other fascinating true tales about science. My guest is Sam Keen. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Tell us about your book that's coming out this summer.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this book, actually. So the premise of it was about the Manhattan Project, kind of an offshoot of the Manhattan Project, to build the atomic bomb during World War II. And the premise is that there were a bunch of scientists who got run out of Nazi Germany. They came over to the U.S., moved here. They started working on our project, Manhattan Project, to build the bomb. And they were convinced, actually, that Germany was far ahead of us in atomic weapons research. Atomic fission had been discovered there. Germany had the best industry in the world. They had top scientists like Werner Heisenberg working there. And these scientists in the U.S. were convinced that the Germans were going to build an atomic bomb, give it to Hitler, and he was going to destroy the world with it. So eventually, they convinced the head of the Manhattan Project to put together this team of undercover scientific commandos and basically send them undercover into Europe to spy on and sabotage, and in some cases even try to assassinate members of the Nazi atomic bomb project. So this book is about the adventures they had running around Europe trying to hunt down the Nazi atomic bomb.
So it's a little different than your previous books.
It is a little different in that my previous books, I compare them to like a collection of short stories, and that there's a central theme or idea, and I kind of jump off into different areas. Whereas this book is more like a novel, kind of one big sweeping story. And there are really a lot of great characters in there. John F. Kennedy, the president, his older brother, Joseph, actually died on sort of a peripheral arm of this project. There's a Major League Baseball catcher in there named Mo Berg, played for the Red Sox, who was sent over to Europe as an undercover spy because he spoke something like a dozen different languages, very good about going undercover, kind of slipping into things. And he actually met Werner Heisenberg and was kind of on the point of assassinating him. And it's kind of fascinating to think about a Major League Baseball catcher being sent in as a spy to Europe.
Sam, this seems like a movie. Is anyone after you at the movie rights?
They haven't yet, but I would love to do it. It was a really fun book to write. Yeah.
We'll go to a tweet. What science mystery keeps Sam up at night? Or which does he want to explore next?
There's a couple of areas of science that I really do think a lot about. One of them we hinted at earlier. One is astrobiology and whether life exists on other planets. I'm fairly confident life exists on other planets. What I'm less confident about and really would like to know about is whether intelligent life exists on other planets. So there's probably microbes out there, sort of basic rudimentary life, but is there complicated, complex intelligent life out there in the universe? And if there is, why haven't we seen it? Why is it too far away? Is it just so unlikely? So that's something I really, really think about. And if I could know the answer to one question, I think that would be it.
An email from Susie: if he could require all of us to understand just one scientific fact, what would it be?
Ooh, that's a very good question. Just one scientific fact. I think it would be, I think sort of the basics of, like, chemistry, how an atom is put together, how it works, something like that. And also how those small structures build up into larger structures. I think when you understand that about the world and how they work, it really kind of changes your view of what things are made of, how the body works even. Something like, I mean, go back to the periodic table, it really is the basis not only of chemistry, but all of physics, all of biology. So if you had a basic understanding of those things, it really can kind of improve your scientific outlook on the world.
We'll go to Mark, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I personally have renamed our species from Homo sapiens, the wise man, Homo avaris horribilis, the greedy, horrible man. On the basis of what I've read we did to the other members of our genus, the other species of man, and what we are continuing to do to the entire planet now. So I want to ask two questions. What do you see as redeeming for wanting, as you said earlier, to see the continuation of humankind in the universe? And is it not a fact that given the progress of overpopulation, there are just too many people on the planet, and we have thwarted nature? We refuse to die, and we refuse to limit our production, our reproduction.
All right. Well, big thoughts. Your book's about the history of gases.
Yeah. But I've written about other things. He mentioned, he was alluding to at least, Neanderthals and things like that who ended up dying out. Possibly, we don't know exactly, possibly because of human activity, things like that. And it's a fair question. If you want to look at the sort of overall balance of life on Earth, are human beings good for it? Are we not good for it? I think we're mostly partial, and we want to preserve human life and human civilization because we are human beings. And so I think we're definitely well worth saving. Human life is so interesting and so rich in some ways that I do want to preserve it. This question about overpopulation is a good one. It's a question a lot of people have been asking. We have medical advances that obviously save people's lives. They extend lives. They end suffering. They're all amazing. They do also, though, increase the number of people on our planet. And that's not a bad thing, but perhaps if we had fewer people, we'd be able to keep a little bit better balance. And the question is how we achieve that balance and what ways we can go about doing it. It's going to have to be a voluntary thing. I don't think any one of us want to talk about coercion or things like that. But one encouraging sign is that as nations develop, birth rates do drop. So as we, hopefully can help the rest of the world sort of bring themselves out of poverty, it's very likely birth rates will drop at that point. And hopefully we can come back into a little bit more of a balance and preserve the very precious place that we have, our home planet.
An email from John, curious which obscure science story most fascinates Sam.
Which obscure science story? That's another good question. There are some stories in the first book I wrote about the periodic table that I find very fun. There's a chapter about war that I've mentioned. There's one element in there called molybdenum that no one's heard of. I don't think I knew it was an element before I started writing the book. But in the book, I talk about how there was actually a battle, kind of this small-scale battle fought in the United States over this element during World War I, over access to this element, where the Germans sent in people to try to take control of this mine in Colorado because they wanted access to this element. Another kind of obscure, fun fact is that aluminum, it's a metal we all know today, a very kind of common sort of blasé metal, was for a long time the most precious metal on Earth, worth far more than silver, worth far more even than gold was, for reasons that I explain in the book. So these kind of obscure stories pop up a lot with different elements.
An email from John. Thanks, Mr. Keene, for reminding us that cancer's risks are higher due to casual nuclear weapons tests. Frightening. And I agree. I want to ask you about some of the more fun things in your book, though. You have disparate parts of recent human history popping up from Roswell, New Mexico, and aliens to Albert Einstein. So what does Roswell, New Mexico have to do with the air we breathe?
So the Roswell story involves, obviously the alien supposed invasion there. But a lot of the things that people were seeing were actually a remnant of the Cold War. There were a lot of balloons, sort of top secret balloons they were sending up, different things like that. What they were basically trying to do was take advantage of this quirk in our atmosphere where sound gets funneled to a very specific point, and it actually travels very, very well high in the atmosphere. So they were sending balloons again up there to try to spy on the Soviet Union and determine whether the Soviet Union was setting off atomic weapons of its own.
So trying to listen for tests from
basically
that layer of the atmosphere.
Yeah, exactly. A sort of a long distance, kind of putting our ear to the door with a glass kind of thing to listen to the Soviet Union. And the Albert Einstein story involves, we obviously know Einstein from his big theoretical science, but he actually loved tinkering around with everyday inventions. He worked at the patent office. His father and his uncle were both inventors. And during his lifetime, Einstein actually got a patent, along with a friend of his, on a new revolutionary type of refrigerator. And it's kind of weird to think about Einstein building a refrigerator.
Thinking about refrigerators, right.
But he was very interested in those kind of practical home appliance things.
Tell us about the discovery of argon.
Discovery of argon was one of those stories I think you were maybe alluding to earlier about scientists spending a ridiculous amount of time looking for something that was very, very tiny and subtle. And argon is a gas in our atmosphere, maybe one people haven't heard of, but it's an important part. It makes up about 1% of our atmosphere. So it's the third most common gas in there. And it basically involved someone running this experiment for weeks and weeks, months and months on end, to basically eliminate everything else in this sample of air except this one tiny part of it that he just couldn't get rid of, and spent months and months doing this work until he discovered this obscure, unreactive part of our air.
And in the beginning, if I'm remembering correctly, nobody even wanted argon part of the periodic table. It messed things up.
It totally messed things up because it's part of the what's called the noble gases, which if you remember from chemistry class are very unreactive. Helium, neon, they also make nice bright signs and colors and things like that. So they have a use, but they're very unreactive and they weren't discovered for a long time. They were latecomers to the periodic table. So when they did discover them, we didn't know where to put them. And people thought it was going to completely destroy the periodic table. Turned out it didn't. So we eventually figured things out.
Do you have a favorite scientific hoax?
Favorite scientific hoax? Ooh. There are some good ones. Things like, the Piltdown Man or something like that. A favorite one. Is there one that you were thinking about that popped to mind?
No, just wondering.
The Piltdown Man is an interesting one. It was sort of these ancient bones that someone did some very good doctoring work with, and I think possibly even planted them on someone to try to there was kind of a gullible anthropologist who was trying to promote these theories about the origins of human beings, and someone put together like an orangutan jaw or something and put it on, a small skull. And ended up fooling a lot of people for a very, very long time about kind of throwing us off the scent of where human beings had come from, our evolution, things like that.
Sam, your books are so varied. You're talking about everything from DNA to the oxygen we breathe. Is your brain just full of, do you have ideas for 25 books? And it's, what are we going to do next?
I have ideas for all these books. I don't know how, if they'll ever see the light of day or something like that. But yeah, my editor and I right now are kind of throwing around ideas for the next book after The Bastard Brigade this summer. And I do keep a list of things on my computer of just different ideas. In college, I studied actually physics and English literature. So I really got both the sciences and the humanities. And I've always been someone who's been a voracious reader. I like to read about lots of different subjects. I like to read both novels and nonfiction. So I've always been interested in lots of different things.
How long does it take you to write one of these books?
Each one so far has been about 2 years or so, working on them full time, basically. So yeah, about 2 years start to finish. And that includes the, you know, the copy editing and all the stuff like that.
And how do you gather the information? Because there, you know, it really is very packed, and there's so much detail with every single story. I'm guessing for every story you include, there are 10 stories you're not including.
Yeah, there's a lot of details, unfortunately, you have to leave out. You can't write a 800-page book or something like that. A lot of it is just a matter of, you know, going to the library, doing research. It's unglamorous sometimes, but I really enjoy the process of researching. And, you know, I might read a whole book and just get a paragraph out of it. But if it's a really good paragraph, it's often worth the effort it takes to do that, because I enjoy learning about those things and I just enjoy bringing those details to people. It's fun.
Well, I think kids would enjoy science a lot better if they were learning the history of science as they were learning their science.
It does help, I think, to at least tell stories to people, get them involved with human beings. And in fact, you can learn more science than you might think by telling stories, because that's just how our brains work. We remember information very well when it's presented in a story form, when there are heroes and villains and conflict and drama. We remember those details. Obviously, science can't all be stories. You have to go beyond that at some point. But it can be a really good introduction to the topic, and it can help people get excited and interested in it.
Well, Sam Keen, thank you so much for joining us on Maine Calling. You're speaking twice tomorrow, correct?
There's a talk tomorrow at 12:30, and then there's a panel later in the day after that.
And at 12:30, both at the University of New England, 12:30, it's a lecture, and then at 5 o'clock about how to speak science to regular
about science
people.
Communication, things like that, yeah.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. That's Sam Keen. He's the New York Times bestselling author of Caesar's Last Breath, The Dueling Neurosurgeons, The Disappearing Spoon, The Violinist Thumb. His next book is The Bastard Brigade. It comes out this summer. Again, your lecture tomorrow at the University of New England at 12:30, and a panel discussion on communicating science to a general audience tomorrow at 5. On our website and Facebook page, we will have more details. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. This program will be rebroadcast tonight at 8. You can find links and resources at mainecalling.org. Tomorrow on the program, Maine's iconic foods and our food economy. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Calling, a Maine Public Radio.